participation is pharmaceutical marketing in Washington, D.C., expenditures, impacts on health care. Dr. Wood is an associate professor of health policy at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. She's the director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health, and she conducts research with the Project on Scientific Knowledge and Public Policy. She previously was Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health at the FDA from 2000 to 2005, when she resigned on principle over continued delay of approval of emergency contraception over the counter. Prior to her time at the FDA, Dr. Wood was the Director of Policy and Program Development at the United States Department of Health and Human Services, the Office on Women's Health. From 1990 to 1995, Dr. Wood worked on Capitol Hill as professional staff for the Congressional Caucus for Women's Issues. Previously, Dr. Wood was a research scientist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She received her PhD in biology from Boston University. Welcome, Dr. Wood.
Thank you. So this is a sort of change of topic, but I think the underlying theme of trying to ensure quality health care will pervade the whole panel, but this is looking at it from a somewhat different perspective, which is pharmaceutical marketing, and particularly with data that we're getting from Washington, D.C., because of legislation they passed there. I will note no financial relationships that need to be disclosed. So, as we all know, the cost of pharmaceuticals has become an increasingly large proportion of our healthcare expenditures over the last few decades, and now accounts for 10% of healthcare expenditures, and has been the fastest growing segment. And that's both in terms of the cost as well as the number of the products being sold. So the number of prescriptions have grown by nearly 40% since 1999. And then, as was mentioned, most of the new products, if they are brand name, you know, new to the market, they will have protection and market exclusivity, and are much more expensive than the products that have been on the market for a while. Now, pharmaceutical products obviously have made great strides and provide great benefit to one's health when used appropriately. But this is talking about sort of the other side of inappropriate marketing. Now, we know that the pharmaceutical companies use a lot of techniques to promote particularly the use of brand name drugs. And these include detailers to providers, including samples and other gifts. They may be providing providers or prescribers, actually, as well as speakers or consultants. They provide gifts, such as food, travel, and so forth. They also do advertising, both to providers and to consumers. And they also fund organizations of all types related to healthcare, and especially those involved with CME, continuing medical education, or patient education. And then, of course, they also sponsor clinical trials at medical centers and academic places around the country, and that helps, you know, sometimes they're developing new products, but this also sort of builds the product use of that particular time in that region. So the District of Columbia passed a law back in 2004 called AccessRx, and every year since then, they've been required, actually starting in 2006, to provide data on their advertising, gifts, and what are called aggregate expenses. And they have to report that to the D.C. Department of Health by July 1 every year from the previous calendar year's marketing. And they are considered marketing expenses. So they have to have their advertising expenses, that only the portion that is specific to D.C., not their national advertising. They have to provide information on gifts to all persons and entities licensed to provide health care in the district, including healthcare professionals and persons employed by them in the district. And that excludes gifts valued at less than $25. It excludes clinical trial expenses, and it also excludes free samples for patients. And then the aggregate cost, this is this lump sum of all forms of payment to employees and contractors engaged in advertising and promotional activities. So this captures, and unfortunately not at the detail that we would like to have, the money spent on detailers and other expenses by staff, part-time staff, people who work in the district on behalf of the companies, and it's sort of a lump sum that they provide. So the School of Public Health and Health Services, and I lead this project, has been contracted since 2006 to do the analysis of the company's submissions and report this in aggregate form back to the D.C. Department of Health. And you can find the reports that we filed back to D.C. Online. But we're now reporting sort of some of the data sort of as we look back over several years. We've done a couple of different slices of the data. So if we look at the total marketing expenses in D.C., you can see they started around $150 million in the District of Columbia alone. So this is not including Maryland or Virginia. This is within the borders of the District of Columbia alone. $145 million and $158 million the first couple years. We did see a drop last year down to $96.1 million, and we honestly don't know what's the cause of that, whether this is a part of a national trend in flowing the money in other ways that aren't measured, or whether the recession or whether the types of marketing are coming in different channels that we're not capturing. We can't tell you the why, but we can tell you that there was this reduction. But it's still roughly $100 million that is spent last year, or in 2009, in the District of Columbia only. So how does that break out? That aggregate figure, the purple part of that graph, are the employees and contractors, nearly 70%, and that's remained constant. This is the biggest chunk, and we have the least amount of specific data on, but this is the detailer pool, the amount of money spent on detailers in the district. Gifts make up another 23%, and advertising 8%. Now, we wanted to dig in a little more deeply on the gifts, because we do have a lot of data on who the gifts are given to and for what purpose and what type of gift. Food is the most commonly given gift, but it's also the cheapest form of gift. So they accounted for 81% of each individual gift given, but it's only 11% of the value. Because food is cheap and plentiful, this comes in meals to practices, meals for seminars, meals for taking a group of physicians or nurses out to dinner for an evening talk, paying for those meals. So that again, it was very frequent but not very expensive overall. Money, direct money, was given much less frequently, but the total value is much more. So it's only 8% of the gifts, but it accounted for 51% of the value of those gifts in 2009. So $11 million. Now these are mainly gifts for, you know, speaking, consulting, grants, these types of things given out. Now we look at specifically at physicians. Now physicians received $7 million of the gifts, which is, we had gifts given that came to individuals, like individual physicians or nurses or other prescribers. We also had gifts that went to organizations, hospitals, patient groups, health professional organizations. But within individuals who got gifts, physicians got the most, not surprisingly, and got 90% of the value, and 74% of each of the number of gifts went to physicians. The largest single gift was a $40,000 payment, consultant payment, but the median was $55. So a whole lot of people are getting not much at all, and then some people are getting a whole lot of money, which skews the mean. But the median is quite low, so half the population is getting less than $55, but some people are getting as much as $40,000 in a single payment. This is in single payments gifts. Food, again, accounted for 81% of the gifts, but money accounted for 68% of the value of what they were getting. And 10 physicians between them got a total of $1.7 million. So there is a small group of physicians in the district who get a great deal of money. There's a large group of people who get a much smaller amount of money. And we think those are different types of marketing strategies. And interestingly enough, the pharmaceutical companies classify this money as part of their marketing budget. I mean, this is for consulting, this is for speaking, but it is not being billed out of their research or R&D budget. It's part of their marketing budget, and they report it. We looked at the physician gift categories. We looked at food. So what were these, aside from being cash, what were they for? Food. We had nearly 700 physicians getting 10 or more meals during the course of the year. So that's sort of like a monthly visit, getting lunch paid for. But about 50 physicians got about once a week frequency of food coming from a company. Speaker fees, the payments to physicians totaled $4 million. Again, the mean was $4,255, but the median was $126. So again, you can see it's a very skewed curve with a lot of people getting small amounts, and then this group getting quite high amounts. With five physicians, this is speaker fees only. This wouldn't be their total amount of gifts. This is just, again, digging down a little bit, looking at speaker fees only. And five physicians got more than $100,000 each in speaker fees, generally from multiple companies. Again, in the district alone. So we looked at non-individual recipients, so these would be the organizations, and we then looked at sort of the top 10 of what we would sort of loosely classify as professional organizations or disease-specific organizations or clinical organizations. So the top 10 professional organizations got nearly $4 million. Disease-specific organizations got $1.6 million. And the top 11, because there's a tiebreaker, got $1 million. So there was, and so we wanted to look at what organizations were getting from. But I should mention that we are bound under confidentiality clauses that are written into the law. The D.C. law is not a Sunshine Act. It is the District of Columbia was interested in this information because it's such a huge payer for health care in the District of Columbia. So they're interested in having this knowledge for their own purposes. Financing, it was not written as a transparency sunshine law, and we do think that that should be changed. But that being the case, we are under confidentiality agreements that cannot allow us to tell you or anyone else who these organizations are, who the physicians are, and so forth. We're not able to do that unless the law changes. So as I mentioned, DC is interested in this data because of the amount of pharmaceutical spending in the district through DC Medicaid and its other health insurance programs. There are high rates, as you know, of chronic conditions in DC, including hypertension, asthma, diabetes, HIV/AIDS, and so forth. And DC's Medicaid program is a substantial part of its overall budget, and prescriptions are a large component within that. In 2007, it accounted for $72 million. Now, interestingly, $72 million, but they were spending over $100 million in marketing in the district. So although prescriptions are a large component of the Medicaid budget here in D.C., clearly it must not be that big of that they're getting their marketing through beyond Medicaid in terms of the benefit to the companies. If companies are spending over $100 million, but they're only getting $72 million from Medicaid, but they're spending over $100 million in D.C. for marketing alone, they must be making a great deal of money in the non-Medicaid population. Now, we also want to point out that antipsychotics are one of the top three classes of drugs for Medicaid beneficiaries, but these are often prescribed inappropriately for off-label uses, and we're going to start looking particularly at that area for some specific marketing activities in some of the future years data that's coming in now. So we wanted to look at the, because D.C. is very interested in the amount of money they spend in Medicaid, we wanted to see how many of those Medicaid prescribers are getting money. And we did a cut at $1,000 or more. Now, so these were looking at people who, physicians who are getting a substantial amount of money from, you know, not the big bucks, but neither are they just getting lunch once or twice. They have gotten $1,000 or more during the course of the year. And we found that 193 physicians who got that much in 2007. And about a third of them were actual Medicaid providers. And some of them were actually among the top 200 Medicaid providers in the two different systems, the fee-for-service and the managed care. So of the top 200 fee-for-service and Medicaid managed care providers, we had about 16 providers who were getting more than $1,000 a year. Now, we're not able, again, to see the prescribing data of these individual physicians, so we're not at this point able to tell you, you know, how any particular physician or prescribing practice or increase in prescribing or decrease was affected by these gifts. It's the type of thing we'd like to be able to analyze, but unfortunately the data does not allow it. So we also then looked at D.C.-based organizations receiving gifts, and we noted that, again, looking at the 2007 data, that professional organizations got $9 million, at least just 10 of them got $9 million, and 7 out of these offer continuing medical education, but we could only find 2 of them disclosing their financial support from industry on their websites. And similarly, the top 10 disease-specific organizations that got $2 million in 2007, only 4 of them clearly named their corporate sponsors on their websites that we looked at in 2009. So in terms, again, transparency, both on, you know, who are the providers getting all this money and are they disclosing it, particularly if they are providing educational activities, that, you know, we think that that's something that's clearly not being done. Now, it's important to note that the Affordable Care Act, which we all know a lot about, does have the portions of the Physician Sunshine Act, which have been introduced a number of times, incorporated into the bill. So starting in 2012, nationwide, there must be a reporting of pharmaceutical companies' gifts to, but only to physicians and teaching hospitals. It does not get nurses, and it does not get hospitals that are not teaching hospitals or any other organization, you know, besides teaching hospitals. So we have physicians and teaching hospitals, but it will be public. There's the companies have been doing some voluntary reporting. Some of the companies have done some voluntary reporting, and it's put up in the ProPublica database online. But this new law will go nationwide and be mandatory, but it is limited to physicians and teaching hospitals and has a higher gift threshold that it has to report. So it's not going to capture, it is going to capture some of what we're collecting under the DC law, but it is not going to capture all of it by any stretch because it doesn't require reporting of the detailers' costs, gifts to non-physicians or gifts to other organizations besides teaching hospitals. And so we did sort of a rough calculation that we took out. If we use the standard under the new law for DC, only $8.3 million would have been reported in 2009, which is less than 9% of the total that we captured in the data that is reported. Now, the flip side, the good part of it is that 9% will be public in terms of the names. But DC is going to be reviewing the law and trying to make sure they're compatible because the ACA says that that states and the district can have broader requirements but can't duplicate what is in the ACA, and so they need to be brought together and made consistent between the two laws. So we're very interested in what the this is being led and has been led for many years by Council Member David Catania here in the district. And so we're very interested in how both the General Counsel in the district and Mr. Catania will be moving forward on aligning these laws. So our recommendations for moving forward, of course, to increase the transparency under this law. We would love to have more information. We'd like to be able to publish, you know, our findings by name and by detail, but we're not allowed to do that. And we would like to have some better data, perhaps, on what exactly we're asking the companies what exactly they're marketing for. We don't have that data. They don't have to report that. We think it's important to expand prescriber education to help them be aware of sort of rational prescribing and also the impacts of marketing on prescriber behavior. And we would like to be able to, through transparency and other mechanisms, be able to limit those potential conflicts of interest in the continuing medical education that is provided to physicians and other prescribers. Thank you very much.
A second great talk and very provocative. I know I'm jotting down a lot of. Okay, so the third talk is from Mr. Arthur Levin. The name of Mr. Arthur Levin's talk is Improving the FDA's Advisory Committee Process, the View of a Consumer Advocate. Mr. Levin is co-founder and the director of the Center for Medical Consumers, a New York City-based nonprofit organization committed to informed healthcare decision-making, patient safety, evidence-based, high-quality medicine, and healthcare system transparency. Mr. Levin was a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee on the Quality of Healthcare that published To Err is Human, we all heard of that report, and Crossing the Quality Chasm. Mr. Levin also served on the committee that wrote Knowing What Works in Healthcare, A Roadmap for the Nation, which was published in the fall of 2008. Currently, he serves on two Institute of Medicine committees, one focused on patient safety and healthcare information technology, the other on the learning healthcare system. Mr. Levin ended 4 years of service on the FDA's Drug Safety and Risk Management Advisory Committee in May of 2007 and served on a number of FDA Advisory Committee panels as a consulting expert in drug safety and risk management, representing consumers. He also serves on the boards of the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision Making and the Citizens Advocacy Center in Washington. Mr. Levin earned his Master's of Public Health degree in Health Policy from Columbia University School of Public Health and a Bachelor of Arts degree in Philosophy from Reed College. Welcome, Mr. Levin.
So, apologies, I don't have PowerPoints because this is mostly a sort of narrative story of my experience with advisory committees sitting at the table. So, as you heard, I was the consumer representative on the Drug Safety and Risk Management Advisory Committee, which was a new committee formed in 2003. Came out of another drug committee which really looked at illegal drugs and somehow morphed into this Drug Safety and Risk Management Committee as the FDA began to focus more on concerns about safety and how to manage safety risks. And I served 4 years in that capacity. You get one term and that's it. I rotated off in 2007. Prior to 2003 and then after my term ended, I did serve as a special government employee consultant on drug safety on several interesting committees. So let me give you just some general background about advisory committees. And I just want to say a lot of what I say is sort of structured around my experience with drug advisory committees. It's a little different with medical devices. I just want to say a word of thanks to Diana publicly because most advocacy organizations focus on drugs and have left devices out there alone. And Diana, much to the credit of her and her organization, has really honed in on this vacuum that we've had among advocates to sort of focus on devices. So the FDA relies extensively on technical advisory committees to support its process of evaluating, improving, and regulating new medical products. The advisory committee's system is the primary means through which the agency solicits independent, I'll put in quotes, technical and scientific advice on topics like new drug applications, biologic license applications, new animal drug applications, pre-market approval applications for medical devices, as you heard in a very sort of not very robust way, pre-market notification for other medical products. Some of the topics that come to advisory committees are a little different. They include the review of guidance documents. They include a discussion of trial design considerations and general criteria for the evaluation of medical products and other regulatory issues that are unrelated to a specific product. Now, advisory committees are not the only means by which the agency solicits independent opinion on these topics. Other avenues include informal and formal contact between agency professional staff and outside professionals from the worlds of clinical medicine and medical science. While most advisory committees are chartered with a specific focus, a few are chartered with a focus on broad policy concerns related to the agency's total portfolio responsibilities. That is, they're really not dealing with specific products. They're dealing with general policy. Food is one. There's a scientific advisory board to the commissioner and other sort of general advisory committees. Now, the FDA, I believe, from my experience, not only is relying on advisory committees for obtaining expert specialized advice, but also to lend credibility to the decisions it is charged to make, especially those focused on the approval, regulation, and post-market surveillance of medical products. By bringing together specialist experts and having them review, discuss, and make recommendations based on the available evidence, the FDA, in a way, immunizes itself to some degree from outside criticism of its own scientific capacity and independence. Now, this is important because it's sometimes hard to remember, at least on the part of advocates, that who generally think that FDA is too close to industry, that there are a lot in industry and policymakers in Congress that think the opposite is true. So in my experience, the agency's desire for outside expert advice reaches a crescendo when the product or policy at hand is very publicly controversial and controversial within the clinical community. Now, advisory committees also provide a structured opportunity for input, albeit very limited from the larger public. FDA Advisory Committee proceedings are governed by the Federal Advisory Committee Act, FACA, and are almost perfectly transparent, almost. The public is invited and accommodated no matter how many show up. FDA videographers capture the proceedings in their entirety. They're voice recorded and they're completely transcribed, and those transcripts are available on the FDA Advisory Committee website in their entirety. There's a pre-announced time at each meeting, for those of you who haven't been to a meeting, usually an hour that's set aside for public comment. But those who sign up are given very, very short time limits, 2 to 3 minutes, for their oral remarks. And these are vigorously enforced. They cut off the microphone at 2 minutes or 3 minutes. Written testimony can be submitted for distribution to the advisory committee as well. And to my knowledge, there are no restrictions on the length of those written comments. In my experience, those who provide comment in the public session, more often than not, are there, at least in the case of drug-related advisory committee meetings, to support the approval or continued marketing of a drug they believe changed their experience as a patient for the better. Many represent patient or disease advocacy organizations that may or may not receive industry funding. While speakers are asked to disclose any industry funding, even if they were paid to come to the meeting, because of the FACA regulations, they must be allowed to speak no matter what their response is or if they give no response at all. Many of the organizational speakers represent extremely small organizations, often an organization of one, and some are undoubtedly astroturf, a term that's used to describe consumer advocacy organizations in quotes that are actually established by the makers of medical products. The bulk of testimony during these public sessions can feature a preponderance of emotional anecdote that can be uncomfortable for committee members and compelling at the same time. Now, while FACA mandates the opportunity for the public to speak at advisory committee meetings, in my experience, the testimony does not usually contribute to a more robust evidence base for the committee's decision-making. But mixed into this public testimony are a smaller number of speakers who present information that can be helpful to the committee's deliberations. But those speakers, often representing consumer advocacy organizations, confront the unfortunate reality that transparency is far less robust when it comes to the timely access to briefing materials that provide the evidence-based content of the meeting. For decades, briefing material was not made publicly available until the morning of the meeting. That meant that the work of developing any meaningful and focused public comment was difficult, if not impossible. Under considerable pressure over many years, including, I think, a petition filed by Public Citizen some years ago, the FDA issued new guidance in 2008 that required the web posting of both FDA and sponsor briefing materials at least 2 days prior to the committee's meeting day. While clearly an improvement over access only on the morning of a meeting, it still remains difficult for advocates to undertake a proper analysis of the data being presented by the sponsor, to review the conclusions of FDA reviewers, and then prepare their testimony. There are usually two sources for the briefing materials provided for each advisory committee. The sponsors, which is a lot of the information that's in the clinical trial, the new drug applications require, and that's for drug committees. As you heard, it's not true for device committees, where clinical trials are an oddity rather than the norm. The FDA also provides the other part of the briefing material. And that briefing material from FDA, again, is FDA staff, professional staff, have reviewed the sponsor's material and offer an analysis and comment to the committee on that material. Now, there's some information that typically is exempt from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. And while advisory committee members who receive their briefing materials will have those exempt materials included in their packet, that is absolutely not available to the public in any way. Now, some of these things may not be of interest to advocates, others may be. I would suggest that the clinical raw data and manufacturing quality control information are critical issues that should be a matter of public disclosure, but those are actually granted exemption from public disclosure. Now, the flip side of all this transparency of an FDA advisory committee meeting is that there's sort of a fishbowl atmosphere, especially when the agenda is controversial. I've been at meetings where there are overflow rooms for the literally hundreds of audience members. Now, while there's always some press in the audience of every meeting, it's usually trade press, but when you have a controversy, everybody's there. New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, all of the big newspapers and other media are there. Now, whether or not this highly charged environment has a chilling or other effect on how advisory committees debate the issue and reach their conclusions, I really don't know. I don't have any evidence of that. But I will tell you, it really is this sort of highly charged atmosphere, and I cannot but think that there is some influence of that highly charged atmosphere on how the committee interacts and how they reach their decisions. Now, just one interesting artifact as an advocate is when I went to my first meeting, I noticed that there was a substantial block in the audience of extremely well-dressed men and women. Guess who they are? They come from the sponsor. The sponsor brings an army of folks. Some of the folks that are in that block are experts who the sponsor may call upon to answer questions that are directed at the sponsor, either by the FDA briefing or by the committee members. But a lot of them are just there to remind us how powerful and well-resourced this industry is, I believe, at any rate. One little side comment is that the resources available to sponsors is just amazing. So in this back and forth where committee members are asking questions of the sponsor, they may not have the information in their briefing packet, and they have this army of people with computers and earpieces, and all they do is say, could you bring up slide 2562, please? And there it is. So this is this presence is sort of an overwhelming phenomenon that I think probably does have an effect on how the proceedings go. Now, Fran isn't here, but I just want to acknowledge that certainly an area of great concern over the past decades has been the degree to which advisory committee members are free of conflict of interest. Now, FDA is looking to advisory committees not only to provide expert and specialized advice, but advice that is independent. And so freedom from conflict of interest is a really important concern. In this context, independence is defined by the FDA as being free of influence by the sponsor of a product under consideration by other entities or persons that could gain or lose as a result of the outcome of the process and by the FDA itself. In other words, free, independent of FDA and independent of a sponsor or a competing sponsor. So when you fill out the conflict of interest form for a specific meeting, so you fill out one to become a special government employee and a member of a panel, but then before every panel meeting, you get another form. And it lists not only the sponsor, but everybody who might have a product that will be on the market and competing with the sponsor's product. So for me, that is an important issue. And but in my experience on these committees, I have come to believe that there may be a more important issue, which isn't dealt with in the law, and I don't think is very effectively dealt with by FDA and how it puts together advisory committees. It's the issue of bias. And particularly the interest, the issue of specialty bias that is brought to the table. Now, if you've been in an FDA meeting, you'd know that, and you've seen, that there's one consumer representative usually. There may be a patient representative. This is somewhat new. And then there may be a biostatistician, and there may be a pharmacoepidemiologist, and a few other sort of highly specialized individuals. But everybody else is a doc who is either an academic in the specific area of focus or is a clinician working out serving the general public. Most of them are academic, so they're clinicians slash researchers. When I walked into my first meeting, I was struck by how everybody on the committee knew each other. This sort of this good old boy, more often I mean boy, network of people, all of whom work on the same issues and know each other. And so for outsiders, this is quite a foreboding and forbidding experience. You walk into a room, you're the other. And I'm sure the same is true for the epidemiologists and other non-clinical experts that are at the table. So we know that everybody has a bias. I have a bias, you have a bias. It's expected. It's how you deal with that bias in this kind of setting. So there are a number of things I would suggest. One is, just as there's a declaration of conflict of interest, there should be, I would say, at least an oral declaration of bias at the meeting, when the meeting starts. Now, the Institute of Medicine, the National Academy of Science, did this. If you've ever been on it, IOM committee, it's not. There's not only a conflict of interest disclosure form that you sign, but in an executive session, you go around the room and everybody sort of updates their conflict of interest issue, and they talk about their bias. Now, that's important because it helps other committee members understand where someone is coming from and what those biases may be. When they are listening and considering the advice of that committee co-member in the deliberations. So disclosure certainly would be one change. The other thing is, and the IOM does this, whether it does it as well as it thinks it does is another story, but what IOM would say is we deal with bias by having representatives of every possible bias around the table. We counter bias by having opposite bias. And so at the end of the day, we don't have a bias committee because we have committees that will take a long time to reach consensus because we have put together at the table people who are coming from such different perspectives. And we know they are. And that's why we want them there. So I know this is a different setting and the need for this specialized scientific input, whether it's for science's sake or, again, for cover, is a matter of discuss, I think that we could discuss. But it just seems to me that the FDA could do a better job of incorporating in the choice of who sits on advisory committees, people who will sort of counter each other in their bias perspective. The specialty bias is overwhelming. So let me give you an example. Take you back to February 2005. The FDA had an extraordinary three-day meeting, never happens, of the Arthritis Drug Advisory Committee, the Drug Safety Risk Management Committee, of which I was a member, and about 10 or 12 additional experts in medicine, science, and scientific method. The subject was the safety of the blockbuster drugs known as COX-2 inhibitors. Okay? Celebrex, Bextra, and Vioxx. Vioxx had already been withdrawn from the market by its maker, Merck, because of evidence from its own studies that users were put at an increased risk of adverse cardiovascular events, such as heart attack and stroke. At the time of the hearing, the two remaining COX-2s, Bextra and Celebrex, were still being marketed, and there were actually several other COX-2 drugs in the approval pipeline. They hadn't come in front of the FDA yet, but they were getting close. Now, this gave me a bird's eye view of specialty bias at work. The members of the Arthritis Drug Advisory Committee, mostly rheumatologists, with a pain management specialist or two mixed in, were consistent in their support for all three drugs to be available on the market, despite the presence of substantial and, to my mind, convincing evidence of high cardiovascular risks among users. In their arguments, in their body language, in their facial expressions, the members of the Arthritis Advisory Committee made it clear that they resented the intrusion into their area of expertise, the input of the Drug Safety Committee members, and other panelists, consultant experts. Their bias, and they openly stated it, was that they needed and wanted as many therapeutic drugs as possible because of the idiosyncratic way that individuals respond to one drug, but not to others. And they argue, in defense, that in their practices, they had not seen any evidence of cardiovascular risk in their CV patients. So, evidence, as anecdote is evidence. And they also said that they spent lots of time with their patients in discussing the benefits and risks of all of the possible interventions. And I remarked, and it was my turn, that study evidence is that physicians spend a couple of minutes at most discussing the benefits and risks of therapeutic interventions with their patients. So it seemed inconceivable to me that rheumatologists were this exception that spent this inordinately long time discussing these risks. So we have this bias of, one, a professional need to treat. I'm a doctor. I need to do something for my patients. Two, the bias that I know better than anybody else what really is going on. I see my patients. I have lots of experience. And because of that bias, there were three votes taken on three questions. Should Vioxx be on the market? Should Bextra be on the market? Should Celebrex be on the market? So on Vioxx, believe it or not, Merck had voluntarily pulled it because of the risk. The specialists won the day, and there was a majority, slim majority, that voted to leave or return Vioxx to the market. On Bextra, still a majority, a little more robust. And on Celebrex, the vote was 31-1, and you can guess who the one was. Now, what was interesting is that the specialty bias, the clinical bias, pervaded even the drug safety and risk management docs, including the chairman, who said, I just couldn't vote not to leave at least one of these drugs on the market. And that it wasn't based on any evidence, but really based on that bias. So I think bias is really a big issue. Another bias is, as I said before, the makeup of the advisory committees and the fact that they're so heavily weighted towards academic clinicians. Clinical pharmacists are notable in their absence. I mean, who better to be on a drug safety advisory committee than a clinical DPharm who's who's in a hospital, making rounds and actually picking the drug for patients. Certainly knowledgeable people. Nurses, advanced practice nurses, very rarely seen on a committee. And this is in an atmosphere of healthcare reform and transformation, which talks about the importance of team approaches to improving quality and safety. So I have just 2 or 3 minutes. Let me just see what I want to stress. I talked about the lending of credibility to the FDA by the advisory committee process. I really think that is something that goes somewhat unrecognized. It does, I think, it doesn't immunize the FDA from criticism, but I think it allows the FDA to say, see, we convene this panel of experts, and this is what they said to do, and we're doing what the experts tell us to do. And again, remember that the agency doesn't necessarily have a lot of friends among policymakers, especially in Congress. So the last thing I want to say is, almost in tacit recognition of the influence, undue influence of the professionals and clinicians at the table, and the fact that there's sort of this power hierarchy, because you've got everybody together who knows everything about the subject, the FDA actually moved to, and I don't know if it's still true, to electronic instantaneous simultaneous voting. Because they recognize that there might be one person in that meeting who had the power to sort of dominate how the voting came out. And the way they used to vote is to go around the room and you would raise your hand. And if you saw somebody who you knew well and worked with, you might be swayed by that. So there is an improvement, but you still have to go around the room and tell people why you voted. And that can be intimidating. The last thing I want to say is that you're given a set of questions, usually the same day as the meeting, and those are the things that the FDA wants answered. And in many meetings, a number of us said, we can't answer these questions. The evidence base isn't there. We just don't have the evidence to feel confident to say yes or no, or yes, you know, or whatever the question appropriate response needs to be. And unfortunately, that was true more often than not. And so it speaks to the need to think about the approval process somewhat differently, and recognizing that very often the FDA is making decisions with advisory committee advice on allowing something to come to market or stay on the market, to decide what the degree of post-marketing surveillance will be based on little evidence or too little evidence. And that we need to think about, is there a middle ground here? And some of us have talked over the years about a conditional approval process that would at least allow an advisory committee member to say, yeah, I think there's enough evidence to have a limited approval for perhaps a certain set of patients, but I don't feel comfortable saying this drug should be out on the market. Remember, no matter what the indication is on the label, a physician can prescribe this drug for any use, the off-label use problem. So anyway, I'll stop here because we're out of time, and I'd like to have an opportunity for questions with you guys.
Great, thank you. The combination of the three speakers was one of the best ways that I've seen three speakers come in a similar subject in a long time, so really excellent. I open it up to comments. Can you all hear what does DC plan to do with this relationship?
Yeah, please.
Second one is back on that. And I'm just wondering, since a lot of different plans for devices, the effects do show up long term, how you would imagine when you have follow up for 10 years, how do you do a long term study for a device that may not show its promise beyond the usual term of post marketing study?
Okay, so the question about DC, what is it planning to do with its data? Well, it's done a few things with it. I mean, it does, it has had some hearings. Mr. Catania had a hearing back in 2009 where he actually tried to call as witnesses some of the doctors to explain what they did with all the money they got. And they were doing some studies that are comparing the actual trying to get better Medicaid data and prescribing data to see if it can actually narrow things down. They also have another program called, which uses academic detailing to try and counter detail And they have, we're working with a group actually out of Harvard who have staff physicians who, down here, who go around and do detailing in offices about rational prescribing. So it's trying to counter it with other information. One of the things we're going to do in the next year is help collaborate across these two projects so that we provide the names of practices that the detailers need to be working on in particular areas. But they can only hit a very small fraction. I mean, they're like two people going against an army of 1,000 detailers in the district. So it's
For the question about long-term data, you know, you're absolutely right. For implanted devices, certain types, you would want 10-year data. You know, ideally, you'd want 20-year. So the first step, of course, would be to have any data. You know, I kind of settle for a year to start with. You know, for hip replacements and some of the worst problems that have arisen from hips that have been recalled. For example, the metal on metal hips that were promoted as being the best thing for young people as more and more younger people were getting hip replacements, that it would last longer because it was metal instead of polyethylene on metal, and then ending up with, you know, some severe reactions, which not everybody has, but enough that it was noticeable. So have those been studied even for a year or two prior to approval? That probably never would have been approved. And then afterwards, you know, I can see starting with a post-market requirement of 3 to 5 years. FDA has, in some cases, required 10-year data. The problem is the companies don't do it and the FDA doesn't enforce it. So, you know, it's very nice to say you must study 10 years because we have found that the problems seem to arise closer to 10 years than to 5 years. But if the companies lose track, in some cases, Allergan and Mentor, two companies lost track of their breast implant data, like 95% of the patients dropped out within 3 years. So, and then the FDA said, oh, this is terrible. Why are the patients dropping out of the study? In those cases, it ended up the company hadn't provided any incentive for people to stay in the study, zero payment for participation, and no free visits to, you know, so that, in other words, they have to come in for a visit to see how they're doing, you know, for the study, and they have to pay for it. So, you know, who's going to do that?
I just want to add that there is a mechanism for the registries that could solve this problem, and there are countries that require mandatory registries for certain kinds of devices, particularly implantables, so that you have a database ongoing. And it doesn't deal with a pre-approval process, but for the post-market, rather, you know, it's routine. You are required. Industry hates it, but they do it because they're required. So there is a mechanism that could help.
Let's take the question from the opposite side of the room.
Okay. A question and then a comment. What is it? It's interesting that Dr. Zuckerman is talking about how she wants more clinical trials for medical devices. Thank you. And I would agree with you for that. But actually, in the drug therapy device, we're going towards lesser standards, towards surrogate endpoints, towards, I came from the cancer world. I'm now at FDA. So this is my personal view, not my FDA view, is that the cancer world, especially with genomics, is now moving towards condensing the period because it takes 10 years to get to trials and it takes, you know, so long to get through the IRB approvals. And the cancer world is actually asking for a smaller time period. The orphan drugs are also looking at surrogate devices, which makes me a little nutty. And then you get into the idea of genomics, which says that everybody's really on a little island. So I'd like to see how the impact of genomics on medical devices, but also before everybody leaves, there are those of us, several of us from the advisory committee group at FDA who are in the room, and if you want to be an FDA advisory committee member, come and talk to me, and I'll point you to the right people. But I just wanted to make that sort of a little pitch for helping with the process as opposed to just being an observer. We'd love to have more help. So let's talk about genomics.
Yeah, well, and I'll say that we'd love to have anybody in this audience because we need more public health people and more public health experts. And one of the your expertise. You don't have to be the expert on a specific drug or device. Having that expertise of knowing how to look at data can be very, very helpful and useful. And I think all of us are very concerned about surrogate endpoints and use of biomarkers. And there has been increasing evidence that things like, you know, you can, that the drug that lowers cholesterol the most or lowers blood sugar the most doesn't necessarily save the most lives. In fact, sometimes exactly the opposite.
Okay, in the front here, and then behind you.
Thank you so much. Dr. Wood, I wanted to address this issue of conflict of interest and the buying, essentially the buying of our science, which is pretty much been going on for many, many years. And also to encourage us to think of it as an us problem as opposed to an us and them problem. Because drugs are a very complex technology, and if we could begin selling that message to our, particularly in our medical schools and our other health professional schools, that it isn't a case of just Googling the latest. Patients believe that later, the newest drug on the market has no side effects, which of course we know because it hasn't been used in large populations, because we have such crappy post-marketing surveillance system in place. So it will take us 7 years. I think you used the I love Sid Wolf's rule that if it ain't around for 7 years, I'm not using it. And that is the recognition of the length of time it takes for us to experience adverse drug events in community populations.
I'm gonna.
The second point I would make just quickly is that you can go to ResDAC, which is CMS's source, and you can buy data for your DC experience of medication use practice patterns, and you'd be able, and I think grouping the data is fine, the really worst guys and the really middle of the road guys and the really light guys, it's fine. In other words, we really just want to be training people rather than policing them. Because the police force thing never has worked.
So we have about 4 minutes. I know your hands have been up, and then there's two or three here, if we can be succinct, and, just because of our short time.
I guess my comment and question is also for Dr. Wood. I'm a very strong patient advocate. I'm one of those that if I can get a $4 drug, I will. But I'm also a speaker for pharmaceutical companies. And I'm somewhat offended that y'all want speakers to speak for no reimbursement. Are you speaking for no reimbursement?
Yes.
Yes.
Of course we are.
But when you do public speaking, are you most of the time?
Yes.
Yes,
yes
we are.
A lot
of us.
Now, yep, we are. As professionals, we do that to our peers, to our professional organizations, and I speak at least once a month for those. But, for example, not all drugs are available in a generic form. A new Factor X drug is just coming to market. Who's going to educate the primary care physicians if one of their peers does not educate? Are they going to just read it off the website and then know what to do with those patients?
I think that's a bit, there's some very fair questions that you're asking.
Yeah.
And I think I'll make a couple points. One is that, you know, as I said earlier, that we, you know, modern medicine had brought us many benefits, and I don't think anyone disagrees with that. And the question is, how do you go, and then the hard question is, how do you get appropriate use of these products, and which ones are truly better than the ones that are already on the market? New is not always better, and it is, you know, it is true. And when there's, and a lot of the drug companies are manufacturing what are considered me too products. Only, I'm going to say it's slightly better than the last one, only there's really no evidence of that. But they're not filling those gaps where there are real needs as much as they could.
But that's the only programs I speak for is, for example, Factor X, oral Factor X, it's not available. no one else has.
Well, I think, and again, we don't want to paint everyone who takes money with the brush.
Yeah.
However, by creating a conflict of interest, it becomes harder to know. It becomes unclear, and transparency helps. If you are absolutely convinced that what you're doing and taking the money is fine because you know what you're doing is of the highest integrity.
Exactly.
Great. There are many physicians who and speakers who may not feel quite that open about it. And they don't want it known. So transparent, this is why sort of Sunshine Act, if you're comfortable with it, then you're comfortable with your peers knowing because of the content, great. But there are a lot of physicians who will say, you know, I'm not really that excited about people knowing that I take all this money because I prescribe a lot because I do over-prescribe.
But you lump kind of them all together. Hmm? That's my problem. You lump them all together.
So
you lump them together.
Excuse me.
Anyone who's a monetary guest coach, which is your consulting visitor time. If you fly to Washington, D.C. to do a one-hour program,
I think I'm going to now ask for no speaker, but I appreciate that perspective because we haven't heard that perspective from the panel, and there's agreement or disagreement. Some of us disagree with that perspective, but I'm also supposed to announce that Carolyn Clancy will be talking in Constitution Ballroom I in after this. We have one more question, and then it's 12 o'clock.
Franklin Square.
Okay, good. Thank you for your comments. And one more question, please, or two.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Zuckerman. You have a medical advisor. I have a question for you, Dr. Zuckerman. This data you presented today, how much of it is new since February, as we reported, you know, the results that you had in February? Is it the recall rates?
Yeah, I do have a copy of the article that was first came out in February that was published in Archives of Internal Medicine, and a response from somebody who disagreed with our findings, and then our response to that. Most of these data are not new. I think what is newer than February is that, for example, a half a billion devices were recalled as high-risk recalls in the first half of last year, 2002. Half a billion.
Huh?
At more than half a billion, actually. We stopped counting at half a billion because we were kind of running out of time. But the number of people that can be influenced by these recalls is just enormous. And the other thing that's new is that the GAO looked at not just the high-risk recalls, but the moderate-risk recalls. We were focusing on the ones that we thought were the most important, obviously, that can kill you. But all those hip recalls, every single hip and knee recall that has taken place has been considered a moderate risk recall. And some of those people will tell you it didn't feel moderate to them. If I had to get my hip taken out again and replaced, I mean, I was in bed for a month. I couldn't go to work. I wasn't allowed to drive. And I was relatively young and healthy and had a pretty quick recovery. But, you know, I was in horrible pain, couldn't sleep, felt horrible. And had I been elderly at the same time, I would have ended up in a nursing home with nobody to take care of me. So I had to go there. So even what we consider moderate risk recalls can affect millions of people. And just the cost of these recalled hips to Medicare could easily save $1 billion, probably a year, by having hips that last 15 years for a Medicare patient instead of ones that had to be were recalled and had to be taken out within 3 years.
So you're saying you think they last about 5 to 10 years?
Well, we don't know, but for some people, some of those hips are being taken. Oh, I think most hips are supposed to last about 15 years, but some of these recalls.
So your data shows it's more like 5 years, 6 years, 7 years.
I don't have data on hips. I'm just looking at the recall rate and the fact that the patients who have found problems with metal on metal hips have found severe problems that required their hips to be taken out within 5 years.
Within
2 or 3 years.
Okay. And the recall rate data is recent as to this time or up to, say, 2011 or what?
Yeah, I only have it through the first half of 2010.
Okay.
It takes a while to get. I mean, I'm sure that the second half of 2010 will be available. it's very time consuming to analyze the data.
Okay, thank you.
Were there any other questions?
Can we just get an answer to has Hadoopa include scientific?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so prescription drug user.
Yeah, has PDUFA is the User Fee Act, and it has provided a lot of money. Please chip in here. Has provided a lot of money that has enabled FDA to do its job with more staff, but it has also applied tremendous pressure to get products approved more quickly. So we think it's a mixed bag. The FDA clearly needs the money, and they're not getting it from appropriations. And by the way, all the talk about cutting the deficit and cutting FDA is going to only make that situation worse. It's already worse for devices because, for example, the largest drug companies pay a $1.4 million user fee to have a new drug reviewed by the FDA, and that same large company, let's say Johnson & Johnson, would only pay $200,000 for a device user fee, even through the more stringent PMA process. So there's this huge gap, and every time the FDA has to review these, it costs them over $1 million. So the FDA couldn't really afford to do a more comprehensive review if they didn't have more user fees or more appropriations.
Why does it cost that much?
Because I don't know why
it involves everything from reviewer time, which spend months going through the data.
And are
inspection.
They paid for that?
Good job.
I mean, ideally, the FDA would be completely divorced from pharma in terms of payment.
Yeah, and
that's the idea.
And it's not like they're paid by the company. The money comes in to the agency. The agency has hired staff. The staff do everything from inspections of plants to review to post-market surveillance to everything else to managing advisory committees. And that's just one piece of FDA. Let's add on food safety. But the problem is the strings that come, there are explicit written into the agreement strings that come with the funding. The funding comes with time limits, requirements for certain meetings to be held at certain times, and all focused on quick review and quick decision making. It is not, there are not strings about post-market safety, there are not strings about inspections. They're not strict. That's like, well, you just do that with your regular money. But if you're going to get the user fee money, you have to make sure you hit these deadlines every single time. So, yes, the agency is very interested in the broad picture of safety and inspections and monitoring and quality, et cetera, but they have to meet these quick timelines on review and with other money or with the leftover time, do all the other things. So it puts the agency and the employees in a box that they do their best to manage, but with tightening down resources from Congress and more strings that come with user fees, it's thrown the agency off balance. The user fee law is about to be reauthorized. Next June, July, there'll be battles. And the things that advocacy organizations try and put on there are, well, if we have to have user fees, let's add some safety strings. Let's add some post-market research authority. Let's add some other things, as well as increase the overall pie for FDA so that they can do all of the pieces of the puzzle. But we got to where we are because the agency was starved of resources. It needed money to pay people to do these things, and the user fee was the only way to do it. And now we have to just try and balance it, given that the agency could not survive without the user fees at this point in time. They would disappear.
But if anybody's in the audience is interested in working with us, because this legislation is going to pass within the next year, and there's enormous pressure from industry to add on more and more of what's good for industry and nothing on safety kind of reviews or, reviewing direct to consumer ads or anything like that, which we'd like to see. We'd love some partners on.
So just to add to that, as folks who are involved in public health, at the very least, we'd like to see some of the metrics used. The public health industry complain bitterly, and policymakers believe when the U.S. was being left behind. And we, you know, everywhere else in the world that had all these wonderful drugs, we didn't have the process to. So in order to ramp up, to get the staff and resources, to, now everything by law is approved in a year. An expedited process has to be less than a year, 10 months. And there are penalties the FDA incurs if they don't meet the timelines without good cause. So I think what folks in this room need to think about is what would be good public health metric that would be part of that accountability. So it's not just you got it done in 12 months or 10 months, but that the integrity of the process would satisfy in some way. But it's an important issue, and we need all the help we can get in these battles. So thanks.
Thank you to the panelists. Thank you very much for coming. Your comments, appreciate it.